We save the best cases for last. This is the final day of the sitting for this panel. We have two cases on the docket for argument and other cases to discuss once among ourselves once argument is over. First case is United States versus Malcolm Jackson. Mr. Hogan, I believe, or Ms. Hogan, I believe.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Jane Hogan on behalf of Malcolm Jackson. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The Fourth Amendment at its very core protects the rights of a person to retreat to the confines of his or her home and there be free from unwanted and unreasonable governmental intrusion. In this case, the district court committed error by finding that there were exigent circumstances justifying an initial warrantless entry into Malcolm Jackson's home, based solely on a 911 call claiming that there was a domestic disturbance happening in the Jackson's homes, and the exigent circumstances were based on this 911 call and also the presence of someone in the road who claimed to have heard somebody being beaten inside the home. What makes this case unique from other cases, including City of Eunice, is that the door to the Jackson, this is 10:30 in the morning, the door to their home is wide open. So the officers have a clear visual on Mr. and Mrs. Jackson. Yes, they're engaged in a very heated argument, but they're face-to-face, they're not touching, there's no sounds of thuds, nobody has a weapon, nobody seems to be in physical distress, and upon seeing the police officers, they immediately turn and tell the police officers to leave, which is their Fourth Amendment right to do. Rather than respecting that, the local sheriff's office walked into the house in one fluid motion, and Sanchez walks right behind Lieutenant Vinson, and they're in the home, which is the first of what I count to be three Fourth Amendment violations in this case. And so the first point is that exigent circumstances do not exist here, and that the Jacksons also have a right to resist an unlawful arrest. They're arrested for disturbing the peace. They tell the officers to leave. The officers don't do that. The officers are already in the house by this point. And both Mr. and Mrs. Jackson are ultimately arrested for disturbing the peace, interfering with the law enforcement investigation, and resisting arrest, which all of these charges ultimately don't stick because they're not in public. They have the right, you have the right to argue with somebody in your own home and to be free from governmental intrusion. The district court, in determining that there were exigent circumstances, while there might have been reasons to go over to the house, they dissipate the moment that the officers get there and they put eyes on both Mr. and Mrs. Jackson, and nobody is in physical distress. There's also after they're unlawfully seized from the house and put in the back of respective police units, there is an additional Fourth Amendment violation by a protective sweep of the home, which is completely unjustified because the house is already secured, the Jacksons are on their way to be booked.
So let me ask, are you saying the protective sweep was invalid because the events occurred before that were invalid? Or is it independently invalid regardless of what we decide as to the initial entry into the home and the taking
That the initial entry into the home, I think that that's the key inquiry.
I'm just asking you, as a protective sweep, make sure nobody else is there, making sure nothing dangerous is left behind, no child is there, whatever else they may have been checking for. Are you saying that's unconstitutional as a matter of just a view overall, or is it invalid in this case because there's no right to seize these people in the first place?
In this case, Your Honor, and there was no indication that there was anybody else in the home.
That's why you check, isn't it, to see?
Yeah. Well, I think that the two initial responding officers are already in the kitchen, and they've had this interaction. They've drawn their tasers. They've arrested both of them. So the key point of this house is the kitchen. They've already established that nobody else is in the kitchen or the living room. This is a mobile home. It's not a very large place. There's no justification to then, after everything is secured and the Jacksons are leaving, and no officer expresses fear for his safety, for the narcotics officers to arrive, and both of whom know that Mr. Jackson's under investigation for alleged drug trafficking. They arrive subsequent, and then they're the ones that conduct the protective sweep of the home, and they go into the bedrooms and everything else.
When did the officers detect the smell of marijuana?
There's two initial responding officers. Officer Sanchez doesn't testify at all that he smells marijuana. Officer Vinson, who's the first person who testified at the hearing, he testifies that when he leaves his car, he smells marijuana. If you look at the picture from the search warrant, this is a mobile home. There's several houses close by. So he testified that he parked on the road, and as he exited his car, he smelled marijuana. The narcotics officers then testified that they smelled marijuana emitting from the residence after they got there several minutes later and after the Jacksons were already in the home. When the initial responding officers saw the Jacksons, nobody's smoking marijuana. They're inside the kitchen. If there had been burning marijuana or something to the effect in the kitchen, they clearly would have said so. And nobody, not even the narcotics officers, testified that they smelled marijuana once inside the home.
If they smelled it outside, why would they have to say again that they smelled it inside?
Well, I mean, I think that goes to the reasonableness of, or the justification for going into someone's home. I think that while it's justified to go into a car if you smell marijuana during a traffic stop, the home is different. It's a totally different animal. And if you just smell marijuana on the road without anything more, does that justify walking into someone's home without a warrant and looking around? I don't think so. And several states, including Louisiana, have subsequently passed laws stating that this odor of marijuana alone is insufficient to justify a warrantless search. Louisiana's passed such a law after this, of course. But I think it's relevant. And if you look at the pictures from the house, if you look at the not-to-scale diagram that was drawn by the narcotics officers, the only marijuana that's found in this house is a small bag of unsmoked marijuana and some residue or remnants of cigars, presumably containing marijuana, in some ashtrays in the back bedroom and the bathroom. It's not next to the door. It's not from the.
Is it relevant that there was no marijuana in plain sight, or even in the air? Isn't this about probable cause?
Yes.
Can't you issue a warrant based on probable cause that results in no seizures and no finding of drugs?
Yes. I think it is relevant because the district court relies significantly on, well, the odor of marijuana alone would have justified this. And my position is that the odor of marijuana, the subsequent warrant that happens based on the odor of marijuana, cannot sanitize the Fourth Amendment violations that have already occurred by the officers going into the house and without exigent circumstances justifying it, then seizing the Jacksons, then conducting a protective sweep, looking around, then applying for a warrant based on odor, and the allegation that they saw scales and baggies in plain view from the doorway, which I think, again, if you look at the pictures, it's pretty impossible that they would have had that vantage point. Officer Sanchez, one of the two initial responding officers, testified that he saw the scales and baggies once he was inside the home, and the Lieutenant Benson had testified that he was not sure whether he could have seen it while he was inside, he could have seen it while he was outside. Both Benson and Sanchez testified that they didn't pause at the door. They didn't walk up and say, "Are you guys okay? What's going on?" They walked into the house in one fluid motion, and that is not sanctioned by the Fourth Amendment.
Now, Officer Hebert didn't say in his affidavit that he saw the paraphernalia from the doorway, does it?
It doesn't explicitly say that in the affidavit, but he testified extensively at the evidentiary hearing claiming to have seen them from the doorway.
But don't we look at the affidavit supporting the search warrant and not the testimony at the hearing?
Correct, Your Honor. But I think that even reading that affidavit, it says we got there, we smelled marijuana at the doorway. I smelled marijuana coming in from the house. Then I saw baggies and a scale in plain view. And my friend concedes that it's perhaps ambiguous as to whether he doesn't explicitly say I am at the doorway when I see the scales, but it is logical to read that from the corners of the affidavit.
If it's ambiguous, then how do we get to the intentionality element for purposes of any false statement?
I think that I think that's a, I mean, I think that there's several things that point to false statements, and I know that this wasn't extensively briefed by trial counsel in the district court. I know that the district court treated it as if it had been briefed and reached conducted a Franks analysis. But I do think, though, that like the three Fourth Amendment violations that occurred prior to getting the warrant itself can't. These narcotics officers were at the station, and they testified that they showed up for backup because it was a hot situation or whatever. But Sanchez was the backup. This was a routine domestic violence, without injury phone call, and the narcotics officers were well aware that Mr. Jackson was under investigation, and so if you kind of look at everything, it seems more that they left the station and they went there, even though the Jacksons were already on their way to the jail. They went there more as a pretext to finding a reason to search the house, knowing that Mr. Jackson was under investigation.
Any evidence in the record that this was a pretextual visit to the house? Aren't domestic violence situations fluid and potentially dangerous? I mean, aren't those that result in officers getting shot usually?
Of course, Your Honor. But this is not that sort of a case. There's no indication that there's a weapon. They put eyes on them. Nobody has a weapon. Nobody has a gun.
That they can see.
Yes.
From the door.
Exactly. Exactly. They can see from the door. And I think that that's what makes this case distinguishable from even Troop. This court held in Troop that the Constitution requires more than the mere possibility of an exigent circumstance or the mere possibility of injury to justify a warrantless entry. And here they have eyes on them.
They have eyes on them, but you have the wife's sister calling, saying, my sister just told me he's beating her, she can't breathe. They pull up, you have a bystander, a completely disinterested bystander, who says he's beating, words to the effect of he's beating her up in there, and they can hear screaming from the street, mm-hmm. And yes, they can see that they're just standing, but if there was violence just a few minutes before, why was it not reasonable for them to think that the violence might result again any minute?
Well, I mean, if that is the case, they didn't even give the Jacksons the opportunity to walk outside of their house before they entered. So I think that if you put eyes on people, you see that nobody's in distress. Mrs. Jackson is not in distress. She's not gasping. Nobody appears to have injuries. Without even, and such as in the Brigham City case, there's, this isn't like an injury that's about to escalate. They didn't give the Jacksons the opportunity to even walk outside the door before they were already in the house.
So they should have waited until he punched her?
No, Your Honor. No. No. I think that if you walk up, you see, you put eyes on people, and you say, come out. And if they're there to protect Mrs. Jackson, they wound up arresting Mrs. Jackson for disturbing the peace, and they booked her, and they brought her to, so if they're there really because they're concerned, they testified that they never asked her if she needed medical attention. They never asked her if she was in physical distress. They got incensed that Mr. Jackson and Mrs. Jackson exercised their Fourth Amendment right by saying, get out of my house, don't come in here, you're not welcome, and they were subsequently arrested for it. I'll reserve the rest of my time if there are no other questions.
All right, Counsel. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Patricia Jones, and I represent the United States. One thing that my opponent has not grappled with here is that the standard of review on the initial entry is clear error. The district court made a finding of fact that there was an emergency that justified the officers in entering the home to address the domestic violence situation. And that is a factual determination that is reviewed only for clear error. There is no clear error here. First off, there's no dispute about the underlying facts. The police officers received a 911 call that Mrs. Jackson had been beaten. She called her sister. She said she couldn't breathe, and the sister reported that Mrs. Jackson has asthma. The police officers respond, and they respond in force. Not only does Sergeant Vincent arrive, and then he's backed up by Detective Sanchez, but the narcotics officers arrive. And somehow, Ms. Hogan tries to make that into something bad. This is a situation where the police are being told that a woman is being beaten. And she thinks, you know, only two officers should arrive and, you know, that's enough. There is nothing wrong with more officers arriving to make sure not only that the inhabitants of that house are safe, but that the responding officers are safe. They don't know what they're going to see when they get there. When they do get there, a bystander indicates that Mrs. Jackson is being beaten inside the home. The officers can hear yelling and screaming from the house. They describe it as a very intense argument. They describe that there is cursing going on. When they get to the door, they see the two of them, as Detective Sanchez testified, face to face. The two of them are close together, within arm's reach. And they don't stop at the door to wait and say, well, hey, what's going on? They immediately go in. And that's what we would want police officers to do. As you asked Judge Sanchez, Ramirez, she should not have to wait to be punched. The officer should not have to wait until the victim is punched before they go in. The situation is volatile, and they need to react. And the officers both testified about that. They said that the reason they went in was that they needed to separate the two to make sure that everyone was safe, and they needed to know what had happened because they had information that Mrs. Jackson had already been punched, and they needed to address that situation. The district court credited that testimony, and the district court found that that was reasonable. There is no clear error here. And that's really the end of the story, because essentially Ms. Hogan admits that that's the whole case. It matters whether the initial entry was good. Ms. Hogan, in her briefing, would have you believe that domestic violence is not a serious enough crime to warrant an entry into the house without a search warrant. That is not the case. The Supreme Court has specifically said that it would not be reasonable to argue that police officers do not have the authority to enter a home to protect a victim from domestic violence. Additionally, Ms. Hogan's argument here is based on the Supreme Court's decision in Welch v. Wisconsin, which was about a warrantless entry to arrest a DWI suspect. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that it mattered that all they were investigating was a DWI. Later, in Brigham City versus Stewart, the Supreme Court said that is not applicable when we're talking about the emergency aid exception to the warrant requirement. In those circumstances, it doesn't matter what the seriousness of any offense is that the police are investigating when they go in. What matters is whether there is someone inside who is in need either of aid because of an injury or in need of protection from an injury that maybe has not even yet occurred.
But how do you respond to Ms. Hogan's argument that they could see that she was not being injured at the time? If they were there to aid her, how is she also ending up in handcuffs with charges?
Well, how she ended up with charges, Your Honor, is based on her failure to cooperate and her interference in the police investigation. And that is after the initial entry. So the initial entry, they see the arguing going on, the intense arguing going on, the two of them face to face. And the police officer should not have to wait for that punch to be thrown, Your Honor, as you pointed out during Ms. Hogan's argument. They can't just sit here, they stand back and wait, watch the two of them engaged in this intense argument, knowing that somebody has reported that Mrs. Jackson was already beaten. She was already beaten, according to the reports. Now, some of the cases that we cited address this sort of situation. In the Fletcher case, which is out of either the First or the Second Circuit, I think it's the Second. In that case, the defendant had, well, it wasn't a defendant, this was a civil case, but the abusive boyfriend was subject to a protective order. And the police went by the house and they saw the boyfriend in the house, just engaged in a conversation with his girlfriend. And they could see no evidence of conflict whatsoever. None. That's in the decision. And importantly, in that case, while there were numerous instances where the girlfriend, Ms. Fletcher, had reported her boyfriend for abusive behavior, the behavior was damage to property, it was injuring her kitten, it was yelling, screaming, refusing to leave the house, drunkenness. It was a lot of bad behavior that made her feel threatened, but there was no violence. She even testified that there was no violence, he had never hurt her. So the police officers go there, there's no history of violence, there's no report of violence, there's no sight of violence, there's no sound of violence, and they go in the house. First they knock on the door, Ms. Fletcher doesn't answer, then she refuses them entry, they still go in. And it was deemed acceptable because they needed to protect her. But they never saw any violence. The police don't have to wait for that. The Supreme Court pointed out as much. They said that the duty of a peace officer is not merely to render aid to casualties. It is to protect individuals, to restore order and protect people. And that's the situation here. So even if they didn't see the violence actually occurring at that minute, it was their duty to make sure that Mrs. Jackson was protected, that the situation did not escalate, and that nothing bad was going to happen to Mrs. Jackson. As far as the protective sweep, I think that Ms. Hogan conceded that the unlawfulness of the protective sweep has something to do with the initial entry, and so if you go back to the initial entry was good under the emergency aid exception, I think her protective sweep argument fails. But also, it fails under the Supreme Court's case of Maryland versus Bowie, because in that case, the Supreme Court held that even without any reasonable suspicion, you can search the immediate area, including in closets and hiding spaces, of the location of an arrest. And that's what happened here. The kitchen, at least, was the location of the arrest. If the rest of the home is considered outside the scope of that Maryland versus Bowie protective sweep, it doesn't matter because nothing that was anywhere else in the home was used in the warrant application. So the protective sweep would not, beyond the kitchen, would not have affected the warrant. Your Honors had questions about the smell of marijuana from the house. And Ms. Hogan said that Sergeant Vinson's testimony was that he smelled the marijuana immediately when he got out of his car, and therefore he had no way of knowing where it was coming from. But that's actually not what his testimony was. At record page 604, he testified that it was as he was walking up to the porch, he could smell it, and that it was coming from inside the house. So all of the officers who testified about the marijuana smell said it was coming from outside the house. And it's in fact corroborated by the fact that there were burned cigars with marijuana in the house and a hookah for smoking marijuana in the house, which indicates that it was reasonable that the officers did smell marijuana. And of course, Judge Ramirez, as you point out, the question is what was in the affidavit. And the affidavit said there was marijuana smell, a strong odor of marijuana emitting from the house. Let me turn to the issue of the warrant itself and whether there was a false statement in the warrant. First, let me note that this issue is subject to plain error review only because the Franks issue was not raised in the district court. Of all the issues raised in this appeal, the only one that was raised in the district court is about the constitutionality of the initial entry. That's the only one that was preserved in the district court. So on the Franks issue, there is no false statement in the affidavit. The affidavit says that Detective Hebert saw the scales and the baggies in the home in plain view. He doesn't say he saw it from the porch. He doesn't say he saw it from outside. He says he saw it. And there's no dispute that he did see it. So there's simply no false statement in the affidavit. If the affidavit is ambiguous, which I don't think it is, but to the extent that it might be considered ambiguous because the prior sentence was about what happened on the porch, then the ambiguity should be resolved in favor of the truthfulness of the statement. And that's what this court's cases have repeatedly said.
But the district court didn't make a finding that there were no false statements in the affidavit, did it?
That's correct, Your Honor. The district court did not make a finding on this whatsoever. But if there is a reasonable view of the evidence that would support the court's order denying suppression, then this court should take that reasonable view of the evidence, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, and uphold the district court's suppression order, even though the court didn't make a decision on it one way or another. And the evidence, it is the defendant's burden to prove the falsity of the statement. And the defendant cannot show plain error in the court's failure to find that the statement was false. Because, for one thing, two officers who should be deemed credible, if viewed in the light most favorable to the government, both testified that they could see the scales and baggies from outside the home. And those officers, although the district court didn't say, I adopt that testimony and that I find that testimony credible, the district court did find those officers to be credible in other respects. So at the very least, the court didn't reject their credibility altogether. The second thing, and I believe I neglected to say this in my brief, and I apologize, Sergeant Vinson also said that the scales and baggies could be seen from the porch. He said he didn't remember whether he saw them from the porch or after he went in, that it was fluid, that he just went in, and he has no memory of when he first saw them. And of course, obviously his attention would have been directed to what was going on in front of him right then and there. But he said, now you remember later, he was outside on the porch talking with the other officers. He testified that you could see the scales and baggies from outside on the porch. And the judge did find that Sergeant Vinson's testimony on the whole was credible. So that, although that's not a factual finding on the specific issue we're talking about, it lends support to our argument that there was no plain error in the court not finding a false statement.
Well, didn't the court presume there was a false statement for purposes of its analysis?
What the court did was said, even if there was an intentional false statement, the smell of marijuana was sufficient to support the warrant, and there was no basis for suppression. So I don't think the court said, I will take it as a fact that that there was a false statement intentionally or recklessly made. I think it just said, even if, let's put that aside, even if that were the case, the warrant is good because of the smell of marijuana. And I think that's, you know, that's an additional reason to reject the defendant's argument here.
Has this court ever held that the smell of marijuana is sufficient probable cause to enter a home?
Your Honor, in the Thurman case, which is an unpublished case that the district court cited and that we cited in our brief, the court held that the smell of marijuana constituted probable cause for the entry.
Did the court say may?
In one part it said may, but then later in the decision it said that it supported probable cause. That the sentence about may is earlier up, and I forget why, but it later says the smell of marijuana supported probable cause.
Is that what you're asking us to hold here today, that the smell of marijuana is sufficient to establish probable cause?
Yes, Your Honor.
For a warrant to enter a home?
Yes, Your Honor. And I also cited a Supreme Court case from maybe the 1940s or something like that that said, we have never held that the smell of an illegal drug, if it's particular enough that can be recognized, is insufficient probable cause to issue a warrant. And so I think that says the Supreme Court says probable cause can be established by smell. In that case, I believe it was opiates, in a hallway. And the Supreme Court said that's enough. So I don't think there's really a question here. It's not like there's and I suspect the reason there's not a lot of cases about smell of marijuana being probable cause to enter a house as opposed to enter a car is because if you have a smell of marijuana emitting from a car, that probable cause alone justifies the officers in searching the car. So you're going to have an immediate search, and then it's going to the issue is going to be raised in the ensuing criminal prosecution. If officers are outside a home and they smell marijuana, that's not a basis for them to immediately enter the home. That is just probable cause. So unless they have exigent circumstances or a warrant, they can't just go in. It doesn't mean they don't have probable cause. It just means probable cause is not enough to enter the home. And in any event, I don't see a distinction between probable cause in the context of a car or probable cause in the context of a house. And again, we're dealing with plain error here, Your Honor. This issue was not raised in the district court. There is no decision of this court that says while an odor of marijuana will support a search of a car, it will not support a search of a home. And absent that kind of authority, the defense cannot show plain error here. There's no authority that says that, and it's also not reasonable to believe that. Probable cause is probable cause. It is a fair probability that evidence of a crime can be found within. So if the odor of marijuana gives you a fair probability that there's marijuana in the car, then odor of marijuana in a house gives you a fair probability that there's marijuana in the house. And so I don't think there's a distinction here that's important. And besides that, there's no plain error because there's no case.
Well, let's talk about the vehicle then, the search
of
the vehicle. Ms. Hogan contends that after Mr. Jackson gave consent for the search and the initial search yielded nothing, that he should have been allowed to leave at that point, and that continued detention was a violation of his Fourth Amendment rights. I'd like for you to address that.
Yes, Your Honor. If there were only reasonable suspicion that supported his detention, the United States would need to show that the officers were diligently pursuing a means of investigation that was likely to quickly dispel or confirm their reasonable suspicion. But what we're dealing with here is not just reasonable suspicion, it's probable cause. And that probable cause gives authority for an arrest. And when there's probable cause and authority for arrest, the length of detention is no longer important. What's important is that there is probable cause for the arrest. And there's probable cause based on the odor of marijuana, there's probable cause based on the FBI investigation, and there's even probable cause, which I don't think I mentioned in the brief, because he was driving with a suspended driver's license, which is a basis for arrest. But you need not even get there. I mean, the amount of evidence that the police had based on the FBI investigation that the defendant had cocaine in his truck that night, not like a couple of weeks ago when they did a control buy, not, you know, 3 days ago, that very night that he had just gotten between on his, you know, when he was in Baton Rouge, you know, 20, 30 minutes before, there's strong evidence. It's beyond probable cause, I believe. But anyway, there was probable cause that justifies an arrest, and it justifies the search of the vehicle without consent in any event. The vehicle can be searched based on the probable cause developed in the FBI investigation and based on the odor of the marijuana. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Excuse me. Just a few points. If there are any questions, of course, I'd be happy to answer them. But as far as whether domestic violence in and of itself justifies a warrantless entry into a house, I think that every case that is cited by my friend is distinguishable, and I distinguish them all in my reply brief. This is not a case involving a closed door. This is not a case involving a hypothetical, what's happening in there. This is a case with an open door. There's a clear visual on both parties. And recently, in Lange versus California, the Supreme Court has declined to say that it's justified to that the exigent circumstances always exist whenever their police are pursuing a misdemeanant. And in this case, this is a domestic violence call, which the officers testified was a misdemeanor. They're out there to investigate a misdemeanor. They see that nothing's happening. They're ultimately arrested for three misdemeanors, none of which stick. And so the exigencies in this case simply did not warrant the initial warrantless entry into the house. As far as whether there is no distinction between car and house, I think that another recent case of Coniglia, Justice Thomas's very short opinion notes that the home is different than the house. That's repeatedly. And you're right, Judge Ramirez, that this court has never held that the odor of marijuana by itself justifies a warrantless entry or, you know, probable cause to enter a house. The Thurman case, which is the unpublished decision that was relied on by the district court, is very distinguishable from this case. They were investigating somebody who had fired off dozens of rounds of a high-powered rifle. They get to a house, the guy comes out, he's looking nervous and twitchy, and there's marijuana wafting out from the house. And what this court said is that the odor of marijuana in such circumstances may support a finding of justification for entry. So I think that also my friend noted the Bowie decision as to the protective sweep, that the only area of the house that was really warranted for a protective sweep was the kitchen, because that was the area immediately where the Jacksons were arrested. Lieutenant Vinson and Officer Sanchez were inside the kitchen. They were there long enough to get into an argument to detain both of them. One of them drew a taser, so they were inside this kitchen. If you look at the pictures, it's a very small kitchen living room area. There's nowhere where, if somebody's hiding in that general area, I think it would be pretty apparent to the initial responding officers. And what Ingolio says is that by the time him and Detective Hebert arrived, the narcotics agents, the house was already secure. So what if there's no need to sweep the house at this point because the house had already been secured, the Jacksons are already in the back of police units going to be booked, the protective sweep is not justified. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Looks like you don't have any. Thank you, counsel.
And thank you for the opportunity. Thank you so much. Thank you. We would ask this court reverse the finding of the district court.
I note you're a Criminal Justice Act attorney, a very important group of lawyers for our benefit. We appreciate
you, sir.
You taking on those kinds of cases for us.
Thank you.
Always appreciate you as well. All right, I will call the second case of the